Hello.
Hi.
Welcome back to Old Millennials, a deep dive on shallow topics from the late 90s and 2000s. I am one of your hosts, Emily Bejean.
And I am your other host, Margot Poupard.
Before we get into today's topic, we have a very exciting announcement to make. Beginning Friday, October 22nd, we'll have a Patreon page.
Yay. That's right. Another podcast with the Patreon page that no one asked for, but we're doing it anyway.
Listen, friends, we've got bills to pay. We got a podcast to host. We've got some marketing. You know,
we're trying to send this podcast to college, all right? Yeah, and you can't do it alone. It takes a literal village.
California schools are very expensive.
Even and competitive.
And very competitive. And we want to...
And we got to Photoshop this little podcast face onto a crew member and some rowing photos if we want her to get somewhere.
We want our podcast to have a proctor to take the SAT on their behalf. So
wouldn't we all pay for a proctor if we could?
Pretty much. I don't blame Felicity Huffman here.
Neither do I. I mean, who's to say what we would or would not do with a bunch of money?
Who knows? But we're very excited to announce this. We'll be bringing you lots of fun content, including bonus episodes, newsletters, other things that will make it your worthwhile. Anything you want to add, Margot, to this?
Yeah, it's going to be two pieces of content a month. It's going to be one bonus episode, and we're definitely going to be covering stuff that is more contemporary, but obviously still has some overlap with what we talk about on the main show. I guess we got to start getting used to saying the main show now.
The main show.
And then we'll have another bonus piece of content at some point throughout the month. And that could maybe be a newsletter, or it could be a review of a movie, or it could be film commentary. It'll also be like a fun place to chat in the comments since, you know, there's not really like a super interactive way, I guess, like on Instagram, but it's very post specific there. So yeah, I think we're excited to launch a low maintenance Patreon, and we hope that you guys sign up for it. And we are also open to
suggestions
for bonus content, but there will definitely be, and we'll still do mini episodes on the main feed, but there will be additional, you know, after dark kind of Patreon bonus episodes. Did I tell you that I had to explain OnlyFans to somebody who also didn't know what Patreon was?
Oh, and
that
God.
Was extremely tricky.
That sounds very tricky. But I was going to say, you mentioned low maintenance earlier, and I want to tell you where I am today. When you said low maintenance, immediately I was like, so it's like the balayage of media. Like, you only have to do it every 6 months.
Except we have to produce like two things
That's true.
You know, we'll have one tier. It'll be $5 or slightly less. And we just hope that you join Patreon. And we can't wait to see you guys over there. And we've got some fun stuff that we're launching with, and also some Halloween related stuff since
spooky season.
So yeah,
we're excited. That
is an adequate pitch.
Well, yeah. So head on over. We'll be posting about it on our Instagram. So you'll have all the links there. And we're just.
Oh, right. The other thing that we were talking about, which is having an episode or a written format of us talking about the celeb memoirs.
Yes, we want to talk about.
Because I think that really ties in nicely to who we're talking about today. Because talk about a celeb memoir.
Yes.
I want to add to cart immediately.
Immediately. Of course. The stories. The Aunt Viv controversy. Absolutely.
I don't know if I actually really give a shit about that. Just based on that GQ deep dive alone, I'm like, fine, it worked. I want to read the book now. Yeah. Congratulations.
Yes.
Excellent. Even though I don't like who wrote the book with him, I think the subtle art of not giving a fuck is a really paint by numbers. Like, it's literally that episode of Family Guy where Brian's like, I could write a fucking self-help book. And he does it because massively successful. That's that guy who wrote it. Like, that's, I can't unsee it.
As we are talking about crossing over into our new content and new ventures, I think we have a nice segue into today's episode's topic, a man who is one of the biggest crossover stars of all time, so much so that the incredulousness people felt around him going from music to TV and then movies was literally a plot point around how Ben Affleck loses his job in the movie Jersey Girl. I'm, of course, talking about Will Smith. Do you remember this in Jersey Girl, by the way?
No, I don't at all.
Oh my God. Yes. after J-Lo, his wife, has died while giving birth to their daughter.
Spoiler!
20 years too late. 17 years too late.
You don't know who was saving that for their personal bad movie night.
Their Kevin Smith bad movie
night. Well, it's funny that you bring up Kevin Smith because he will come up later in Wiki Wow Wow West.
He certainly does.
Had a stranglehold on the late 90s the way Will Smith and his assorted, I feel like almost his music. Like the second I put on Getting Jiggy With It, I was like, wow, this has been unmatched. Like I think the closest it's come has been Lil Nas X, honestly.
Lil Nas X,
But other than that, I'm like, who else has like this catchy, this short of a song too?
That short, yeah.
Creative sampling. I mean.
Yep. And like just makes Big its Willis, way into everything. Everything.
That Big Willie impact.
As the 90s came to a close and the dawn of the new millennium came, millennium came upon us. Will Smith had the most insane career out there. He starts his hip hop career in the 80s with the Fresh Prince and DJ Jazzy Jeff and has a fair amount of success. Then he goes on to have a hit sitcom in the early 90s, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which ran from 1990 to 96. And then he moves into huge action films, which back then, like, you were either a TV actor, you were a movie actor. Like, you didn't get to do both, basically. His streak in the 90s begins with Six Degrees of Separation and Bad Boys. Then he goes into Independence Day, Men in Black, Enemy of the State, and then takes a slight nosedive with Wild Wild West, which I should note still made $222 million worldwide. But during this string of film hits, he also released his first solo album, Big Willie Style, in 1997, which sold 6 million albums, and then followed it with Willennium, which sold 4.3 million copies worldwide. Will Smith basically wrote the book on how to be a successful crossover star. Will Smith walked so Dwayne Johnson could run. Before we get into it, Margo, what's your favorite Will Smith movie and song?
Okay, I think it's pretty easy. It's Men in Black. That is just canon to me. It is one of his funniest movies, I think. It holds up really well. David Cross cameo. And then I think my favorite Will Smith song, I think it's Miami, unironically.
it's a strong contender for me too. I would say Men in Black is my favorite movie. I was about to say Wild Wild West, which is not my favorite Will Smith movie.
It was just the most recent clip you watched.
Yes, of the very haunting leak.
So, oh my God.
My God. And then my favorite song, I would say, is Getting Jiggy With It, but I would say Miami is a strong, you know, second contender. That one's a lot of fun.
Well, in doing research for this, I went back and listened to Big Willie Style and Willennium, like, back to back. And honestly, Big Willie Style is a stronger album.
Oh, for sure.
And I mean, honestly, the interludes between songs were killing me. They're also, like, they have the lowest plays.
Oh, yeah. It's just like Miami's like 300 million and then interlude is
like 5,000. It's such a steep drop. But I think this just really speaks to Will Smith. And it's like in my, you know, at the top, like assorted thoughts from doing research for this episode. But I feel like there's a reason why the Will Smith list sequels of Men in Black and Independence Day, which we're both going to be talking about, totally suffered without him, because he is such a unique on-screen charm and charisma that's completely unmatched. And you can't just slot a Hemsworth in either situation. I mean, even Tessa Thompson, as gorgeous as she is, cannot save this movie by herself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that it really sort of speaks to, I mean, his uniqueness. Like, they call him like one of like the last movie stars. Like, him and Tom Cruise are on their names alone, you can open a fucking dud like Wild Wild West and still make over $200 million.
No, I would agree. I mean, you just don't, apart from like these days, that kind of money, like, you know, you have Dwayne The Rock Johnson, but really,
you don't have to keep inserting The Rock. You can either just call him The Rock or Dwayne Johnson. You don't need to do
the I called him Dwayne Johnson earlier. I just, he needed to.
I mean,
two
you're
names
giving him
game.
Like the Jennifer Love Hewitt treatment right now. But I think this most recent bout of press for him, because he's promoting King Richard, which looks incredible.
Looks great.
I think really kind of resurfaces why you really love Will Smith, because the last couple of movies I've seen him in, like Bright and Gemini Man, I think did not capitalize on his true gift as like an actor, which is just letting him, I wouldn't say be himself, but letting him add like a little, like his like Will Smithness to stuff. And I feel like Gemini Man was so, like the technology was cool, like see him fight Fresh Prince Will. But I know it, you could not be sustained on that for 2.5 hours. And Bright was like such a fucking shit show. And the whole sort of, you know, message it was trying to deliver was so clumsily done by that shithead director. So it's sometimes it can be hard when you have a bunch of, I wouldn't say flops, but like disappointments, to forget like what makes you like the movie star that you essentially are.
You bring up a really good point with Will Smith, is that he is great when he gets to do his thing and he's fantastic. His weak points are is when he is put into a position where he has a terrible producer or director at the helms of the movie. And I say this, that he is certainly not the only person who suffers from this. There are plenty of other people who would be in the same position. But it definitely comes up in like Wild Wild West with the producer. And like it comes up with
that right, movie. That fucking psycho who was like married to Pam Anderson. Oh my God, I'm so glad you did. Thing
about him.
Because you, every single
his origin story, Margo.
Oh no, I know his origin story because I had to look it up after he'd married Pam Anderson for like 2 days or whatever. I was like, who's this guy? He made, because it also happened around A Star Is Born. I was like, and he's trying to claim credit for the current Star Is Born with Bradley Cooper. And they're like, you have nothing to fucking do with us, you psycho. Anyway, he's one of those like Hollywood types that you think is made up, but you're like, oh, this is who Tom Cruise based his character on in Tropic Thunder. Like that level.
John Peters, like this man, I'm telling you, I'm watching the Nicolas Cage Superman documentary after this. That's what I'm doing. My sick ass tonight is going to be watching the Superman doc.
Yeah, I definitely think that I wouldn't say that he ever suffered from like bad producers, Will Smith, but he, or it's more like executives and like studio people, because obviously Wild Wild West was like re-edited by committee, essentially, with like audience test scores, and that really dinged it, in addition to having a complete lunatic.
Oh my God.
Behind the scenes. Could you imagine as a writer having someone being like, yeah, motorcycles were cool in the 1800s. You just have to fucking write it.
Let's get a mechanical spider up in there. Let's make that my producer trademark.
First of all, hilarious producer trademark. And I kind of like low-key stan, but. But like at a certain point, it's just I don't even know, like you're just exacerbated by the whole, you're just like, I don't, okay, yeah, I'll give you your fucking mechanical spider. This script will no longer be my problem in about 8 weeks. So your crazy is forever.
Luckily for Will Smith, this was a mere blip on his very otherwise very good career.
Truly wild that something like this didn't further derail him. Again, a testament to his charm and charisma and foresight and sheer determination.
Absolutely. And that career really starts with Independence Day, which was released in 1996 and directed by Roland Emmerich. Emmerich's best known for a ton of action disaster movies from the 90s, 2000s, you know, Stargate, Godzilla, The Patriot, Day After Tomorrow, and that Independence Day sequel that Will Smith wasn't a part of because they couldn't afford $50 million, and also it just wasn't very good. And now they won't have any of the other sequels.
Did you watch it?
I watched part of it and was like, I mean, it was, you know, it's not bad. They're like much worse action movies out there, but... It's just, I mean, when you make a sequel to a movie that was so tied to a star and you don't include said star in said sequel, it is very difficult to recover, no matter how wonderful other people can be.
Yeah.
The film was written by Emmerich and Dean Devlin. Devlin's known for writing, co-writing, producing a lot of the Emmerich movies, Stargate, Godzilla, Patriot. He also produced... Eight-Legged Freaks, which I was a part of, like a test committee or like a not a test committee, but they were doing, for whatever reason, the DC area, they were doing testing at a local Tower Records on one of the trailers, and like they had like a marketing group ask me, young woman on the street, I think I was like in high school and I was with my mom, and they asked me what I thought of the Eight-Legged Freaks trailer. Essentially that, yeah, that's my Eight-Legged Freak story. The movie came together super quickly. So this is the interesting thing about Independence Day, for like how much of an epic it is and how long these types of shoots usually take. This is the bonkers timeline. And I'm going to break it down to you, Marco. Emmerich and Devlin come up with the idea for this movie when they're doing press junkets for Stargate. And one of the reporters is like, yo, do you really believe that the aliens built the pyramids? And they're like, no, but they're like, but wouldn't that make for a great movie? And then Emmerich tells Devlin aside, like, yo, I think we've got our idea for the next movie. And then they found out that Mars Attacks was coming out the following year in August of 1996. And that's Tim Burton's movie, which I actually rewatched very recently for the first time in a really long time. But they were like, we got to get this movie out there in July of 96. Like, it has to happen. If we're going to do this, it's going to be a month before Mars Attacks. So they go to Mexico, as one does, and had a 3-week to 4-week writer's retreat where, like, Devlin's in one room typing up the script, and then Emmerich is, like, in the other room storyboarding everything out on index cards. And
I can just hear the cocaine being done.
This is what I thought. Headphones. Cocaine is one hell of a drug.
I mean, it's how you power through a 4-week writer's retreat. All of that is in air quotes. Yes, my voice wasn't implying it.
Power through. Yes, yes, yes. So basically, they come back from Mexico and they offer up this script. They just, you know, send it out, and within a day, they get offers. They just get 9 studios are like, we want this movie. And then they settle on Fox with like a $69.5 million budget. 3 days later, they begin pre-production. So let's recap, shall we? Summer, fall 94, they're doing the junkets for Stargate. They write this movie in 3 to 4 weeks. And then within a few days, just sell off the script and begin pre-production. So then they'll begin filming in July of 1995, but start pre-production a few months earlier. And in terms of the casting, the one person they always had in mind was obviously was Jeff Goldblum for that character, because it's very Jeff Goldblum. And then as for Captain Steve Hiller, Will Smith's role, they had thought about casting Ethan Hawke. But as Hawke has basically said in interviews, he turned it down because he was a bit of a pretentious asshole post-Reality Bites, which checks out considering that character in Reality Bites. He got a copy of the script and was reading it with a friend on a road trip and thought the dialogue was so bad that he literally threw it out the window on a Texas highway. And he talked about this on Conan O'Brien and like said, like, a year later, I was with a girlfriend at the time, saw the movie and was like, wow, I really fucked up. But I thought that was a really funny story. So the other person they had in mind was Will Smith. Fox was against it because Smith had yet to prove himself as a leading man role. He did Bad Boys and 6 Degrees of Separation, but hadn't really been kind of the leading guy. And because people are racist, and in particular, international markets are racist, they were worried that he wouldn't have been bankable on the international market front. Emmerich really fought for Smith, and he was eventually cast. And one fun fact about Devlin and Emmerich, they got basically all creative control for this movie. They negotiated that into their contracts, which is why I think Independence Day like stands the test of time, and Wild Wild West, which had none of those kinds of negotiations, is a shit show for various other reasons. But one of those reasons is that. Other interesting casting story, they also wanted to make the president more of a villain with a twist, who was kind of like heroic at the last minute. And so Devlin wanted to cast Kevin Spacey, who he had known since high school and who had just seen in a rough cut of The Usual Suspects. Ultimately, he decided to go with the good guy portrayal and cast Bill Pullman, which like totally does a better job. Like, one, everything we know is Spacey, like, what the fuck? But also, like, Bill Pullman is a great president in a movie. So filming began in 95 in July. Principal photography ended in November of 95. And then the film itself, once editing, reshoots, what have you, were done, was not completed until June 20th of 1996, just a few days before the premiere. Fox went ham on this marketing budget and basically wrote the script, no pun intended, on how to do a summer blockbuster marketing campaign. They did the $1.3 million Super Bowl ad in early 96, which every summer blockbuster now does. They had a ton of product placement, promotional ads with Apple, Coke, Molson Coors, a line of tie-in toys. They did the works. The film originally had its premiere in the Mann Plaza Theater in LA. Do you know the Mann Plaza Theater? It says it's defunct.
Mann Plaza Theater. I don't know.
Anyway,
if I saw it, probably. Because at first I thought you meant like Grauman's Chinese Theater.
That's
like,
what I thought.
That's
no,
still
yeah.
there.
Yeah, it's very
I mean,
there.
I have to ask more questions like where is it exactly and that kind of stuff.
I'll check later.
Okay.
It was screened privately for Bill Clinton and his family at the White House and then was released on July 2nd, 1996, a day earlier than its previously scheduled opening because it's one when the same day the film story begins in the plot and because it was highly anticipated. It ended up grossing over $800 million worldwide, becoming the highest grossing film of 1996. And this was the year Twister and Mission Impossible came out. And it was the second highest grossing film ever behind Jurassic Park at that point. And this is pre-Titanic, obviously. It would win an Oscar for Best Visual Effects and was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Sound. And that is all I really have to say about Independence Day because there's no Will Smith Independence Day song, unfortunately. But there should have been.
There should have been, and it seems like they righted the ship by the time we get to the Men in Black, because here they come. They won't let you remember. So by the time Men in Black rolls around, Will Smith has firmly established himself as the king of 4th of July. He initially didn't think he needed Men in Black because he'd already done the cop thing, Bad Boys, and the alien thing, Independence Day. Because Men in Black was in development for a really long time, as a lot of sci-fi movies are, there was a lot of speculative fiction on how Smith not taking the movie, how that would affect his career, as Men in Black is essentially canon to Smith's career if you're a millennial. But initially, Smith turned down playing Agent J, but then Steven Spielberg called him. Amblin Entertainment was on board to produce, and Spielberg convinced Smith to agree to take the role. Smith has gone on to say in interviews that Spielberg told him, quote, "Don't use your brain on this one, use mine." Because of his trust in Spielberg's ability and track record, Smith agreed to take on the role in Men in Black. Funnily enough, it was Spielberg who also convinced Tommy Lee Jones to take the part of Agent K. So I guess we all owe Steven a big ol' thank you. But Smith wasn't the only actor being eyed for the role. This, I mean, I'm like imagining this movie with this person cast.
I know the story, yeah.
Yeah, they were talking to Friends star David Schwimmer and offered it to him, but he turned it down because of scheduling conflict, which like, what the fucking shit? That guy has the personality of a wet blanket.
Meanwhile, he did 6 days, 7 nights.
Oh, I remember where he gets cheated on by Anne. Oh, I almost said Anne Hathaway. And Harrison Ford in his little silver earring. I just remember the silver earring when he's like steering the plane. I'm like, that is so distracting. It's like glinting in.
There's a story around that earring. Lighting. Did you know there's a story? Do you want me to share the story?
Yeah, okay. Quickly.
So I'll be quick. Harrison Ford was having lunch with Ed Bradley and I believe Jimmy Buffett or like one other older man with an earring. Ed Bradley was a host on 60 Minutes for many years. And they all had earrings and Harrison Ford was like, yo, why don't I have an earring? They're like, you should get one. And that's why he got one. He was with like his friends and he was just, yeah, that's
the story.
I can't
believe a bunch of these middle-aged men convinced each other that getting an earring was cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, the other what the fuck casting that could have been was Chris O'Donnell, fresh off of Batman Forever. I guess that was the studio's choice. But director Barry Sonnenfeld deliberately put them off because he really, really wanted Will Smith. It's very hard to see Tommy Lee Jones having the same kind of on-screen chemistry with fucking Ross or Robin. Nope. Just another instance of Smith's irrepressible charm and humor being the perfect foil to Jones's gruff straight man. I think most likely what would have happened if they didn't convince Smith to take the role is that no matter who they would have put in it, it just wouldn't have been as big of a hit and there would have been zero sequels. Men in Black ended up being a massive hit, though, both box office and critically. It grossed $590 million on a $90 million budget and was the third highest grossing film in 1997 behind Titanic and Lost World Jurassic Park, which one of those is an Amblin Entertainment production. Men in Black was also nominated for 3 Academy Awards, Best Art Direction, Best Makeup, and Best Original Score. And speaking of the score, we obviously cannot not talk about the song Men in Black. It was Smith's first solo success and co-writing credit without DJ Jazzy Jeff, and it sold over 3 million copies and reached number 9 on the Hot 200 and went certified platinum 9 times over. Smith's debut album, Big Willie Style, which was released just a few months after the film came out. The theme song won Smith a Grammy for Best Solo Rap Performance and cemented him as a bona fide double threat, a movie star, and a rapper. The third single from the album, Getting Jiggy With It, became Smith's first Billboard Hot 100 and it went number 1 in 1998. And honestly, that's all that I have for Men in Black, other than the whole reason why we get Wicked Wild Wild West is because Will Smith said yes to doing Men in Black.
It's mind-boggling how
it's this like revisionist history of like, if he just would have said no, if he just took the Matrix, if he just but he didn't, you know, this is the timeline that we are in, and there is another timeline where Will Smith is Neo and Val Kilmer is Morpheus.
My God. Have you watched the Val Kilmer documentary yet, by the way?
No, because I'm afraid it's going to bum me out.
I know, because he apparently it's like mostly narrated by his son. So it's like his son speaks most of his like what he wants to say, because now he speaks with like a voice box. But
right. Yeah. Well, look, I watched we gave you all the policeman clues, the snowman. And he was in that. And I was like, is that it was one of those things where like he was. The way that they lit him throughout the movie and his voice, I was like, is that Val Kilmer? And I could not tell until the end credits. And then all of the news came out about his throat and stuff. So, yeah, I was just like, I don't know. I just would rather watch Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and, like, live in the good old days.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, what more to say, really, is other than what happens when Will Smith decides to work with Barry Sonnenfeld again and thinks, gee, it worked out with Men in Black. Maybe it'll work out again.
I mean, they literally tried to recopy the success of Men in Black all over again with Wicked Wild Wild West. I mean, it's honestly, they should have just stopped at the music video.
It's, I like I said in my notes, Wild Wild West. I mean, wow, wow, wow. Like,
wow, Will Smith, wow.
This movie is a perfect example of a lot of good people with great talent coming together and making that is something that is just not good. This film was released in 1999 and was directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, who, as you mentioned earlier, is responsible for Men in Black, but also directed the Addams Family movies from the early 90s, which are great. Get Shorty, which is a lot of fun. And also, weirdly, one of the first DVDs my family had in our house for some reason.
Get Shorty.
It's with like Danny DeVito. No, but
Shorty is, I was just clarifying that that was the first DVD in your familial home.
Which, I don't know why.
Well, again, just like you could not escape Getting Jiggy With It, you also could not escape a copy of Get Shorty. I feel like they were in hotels and
everywhere.
Like, beach everywhere. Homes, everywhere, all the time.
Constant rotation. If it was I have just like family,
those, those AOL discs, they were just.
Oh my God, everywhere. I mean, you could have made a coaster out of Get Shorty TV.
I'm sure some enterprising college student did.
This movie was from the get-go in development hell for many years. It began in 1992 when Warner Brothers optioned the rights to the 60s TV show The Wild Wild West. And over the years, it would go through several directors, writers, and actors. The original film script was penned by Shane Black and was set to be directed by Richard Donner, who left the production to direct yet another film adaptation of a Western TV show, Maverick. Sonnenfeld would later get to be director, which excited him because he had grown up watching the show. But from a writing standpoint, the script, much like Coyote Ugly's script, had multiple versions. In 1997, Warner Brothers hired Brent Maddock and Steve Wilson to do a rewrite. The duo met with Sonnenfeld, who was also producing, along with one of the producers, John Peters, who, fun fact, has been Barbara Streisand's hairdresser, and at one point, and later parlayed that into a career of becoming a producer. One more John Peters fact that we mentioned earlier was that he is one of Pamela Anderson's ex-husbands, and they were married for a total of 12 days. Peter is most notoriously known from a career standpoint as the producer behind the ill-fated Superman movie in the 90s that was going to star Nicolas Cage and originally be directed by Tim Burton. Kevin Smith was brought on board in 1997, and Smith has mentioned in interviews that John Peters demanded three things from Kevin Smith in his Superman movie. He says, one, Superman doesn't wear his suit. Two, Superman doesn't fly. And three, Peters wanted the third act of the film to include a fight between Superman and a giant spider. This, of course, never happened because the movie was never made, but 2 years later, there was in fact a mechanical spider in the final act of Wild Wild West. And while this spider was apparently Maddock and Wilson's idea when they were doing the rewrite as a proposed alternative to Peters wanting a stealth bomber, Peters also proposed to Neil Gaiman that they have a mechanical spider in the movie The Sandman. So a producer's trademark, certainly one of the stranger ones that I've heard of in my day. Anyway, enough spiders. Based on all accounts, John Peters is a big reason why all the bad choices were made in this movie, including obviously the aforementioned spiders, but also having Will Smith be in drag. Like, Barry Sonnenfeld has said in an interview that he was very much against this and thought it was super belittling. But at the time, Peters was like a big yeller and like had a lot of power over Sonnenfeld. And so Sonnenfeld felt like, he said in these interviews, like, if this had been a movie he was doing nowadays, he would have walked off the set at this point, but like just felt like he was kind of tied to this production. It was already a terrible movie. And so when it went through those initial screenings with test audiences, Warner Brothers allegedly spent $20 to $40 million to change things up in rewrites, reshoots, etc. Essentially, no one really knows who wrote the final script because there are four people who are credited. And despite all this, though, Smith apparently was a trooper throughout the production and was super professional. And I think that lends itself nicely into what you have some info on, which is the casting.
Yes. Yeah. Is there any movie more universally clowned on than Wicked Wild Wild West? One of the biggest duds of Smith's career and a movie he points at as a major regret. I think a quote he said is, "We could have done better." That's a direct quote. Basically, it's all Barry Sonnenfeld's fault. Sonnenfeld got the blank check treatment after all the massive success of Men in Black and obviously wanted to take Will Smith with him. If you want to go back to that revisionist history of if Smith didn't take Men in Black, then he wouldn't have made the biggest flop of his career because then he would have never met Sonnenfeld. His counterpart originally was supposed to be George Clooney, but he pulled out the night before Thanksgiving after he read the second draft because Smith, quote, got all the funny lines. This theme of Will Smith getting all of the funny lines would be a theme that continues on even with Kevin Kline. It had always been Sonnenfeld's intention that Kline would be the straight man to Smith's funny man, again, replicating the formula from Men in Black. It had worked so well for them in the past, but, quote, "I never felt that the chemistry between Will and Kevin Kline was similar to the energy and personal chemistry between Will and Tommy Lee Jones," he says, Sonnenfeld. "I couldn't convince Kevin, as hard as I tried, to be the straight man. He wanted to be funny. So with two actors trying to outfunny each other, the film was off to a shaky start." Once the cast was assembled, a read-through took place at a horse ranch in Burbank, and I'm really hoping that it's the Circle K where I used to take horseback riding lessons. When Kenneth Branagh arrived, because he plays Arliss Loveless, he had shaved his beard and was talking in the style of his character, so he was using like a Southern accent. And once he committed, he's one of those actors that does not drop
his character
until DVD commentary. Yes, he is Shakespeare and like takes it very, very seriously. Anyway, one of the Warner Brothers executives, Lorenzo Di Bonaventure, was so impressed. They're like, "Oh, we should fire Kenneth Branagh and like cast whoever this guy is." And Sonnenfeld's like, "That guy is Kenneth Branagh. So I think we're good."
I think what's interesting to me about this movie is that they got two major theater trained actors, because Kevin Kline is also a theater actor. Like, he went to Juilliard. He like,
well, thank you so much for bringing that up, because apparently Barry Sonnenfeld was fucking with Kevin Kline and Kenneth Branagh the whole time. There are stories that while they were shooting this movie, he would oftentimes either go up to Kenneth Branagh or go up to Kevin Kline and ask them if they were in a play that he knew the other one was the star in, just to fuck with them. And apparently Kevin Kline also is somebody who loves to stay in character. So he took up painting because his character was a painter. And so he would paint in between takes and setups and stuff, because also this movie took 100 years to finish anyway. And while he did that to like essentially relax him, because he, one of the girls that's like a part of Loveless's gang, I forget which one, would, he had asked if like he could paint her. And so they struck up a little bit of a chatty conversation, and he essentially told her like, "Yeah, so he's like kind of stressing me out, and I thought it was gonna be really fun. And so I'm actually really glad that I'm leaning into painting because it helps me relax." Which again, like, this is very like Mr. Fish out, or like peak Kevin Kline. Like, I'm convinced this is just Kevin Kline. He just brings his Kevin Kline-ness to characters, and there's probably him being the character is what makes the character good, not that the character is necessarily that amazing. He is Mr. Fish outer to me.
Yep.
So Will Smith famously turned down Neo in favor of playing Jim West. Despite his disappointments of the Wild Wild West, Smith said that he had no regrets about his decision, which is Interesting. But he asserts that Keanu Reeves' performance as Neo would have been superior to anything that he could have done himself. And in spite of the bad press that the movie was getting, you can never fault Will Smith for not fully committing. He wore head-to-toe cowboy regalia for the entire promo cycle and the ridiculous music video that was 10 times better than the movie, as my husband calls it, Cisco's Moulin Rouge moment.
Oh my god, but it's so accurate.
Just go to the music video and try to unsee it. You can't.
That is a part-time Baz Luhrmann production if I've ever seen one. Speaking of that press tour, though, there were like 3 corporate Gulfstream jets for the entire press tour.
They spent so much money on this movie.
So much money. They like took all the budget. Warner Brothers basically just like took their entire budget and threw it.
They just basically backed up a dump truck and was like, here's a budget and here's do whatever. Can't believe they spent that much money on reshoots. It's why it was like one of the most expensive flops. I know it still made $200 million, but it was still considered a flop by virtue of how long it took and how much it cost.
So it was $170 million.
That it cost?
Yes, total.
And then it made back 200? I guess that's not too bad, but I guess maybe it's just not worth the pain of all of the production.
No.
I think mostly once you get back into reshoots, you're essentially in the danger zone. You know, like a studio doesn't like that. Even if you make back the money, they're not happy about it. But they were trying to rip another page out of the Men in Black tour because they lined up Will Smith's second album to support the release of the movie, as he had another theme song as the single, Wild Wild West, featuring Drew Hill. Remember Drew Hill?
Yeah.
And Kool Moe Dee and Cisco. It topped the Billboard Hot 100, went certified gold, and Millennium eventually would reach number 5 on the Billboard 200 and was certified double platinum. Will 2K, the second single from the album, reached number 25 on the Billboard Hot 100, and that's because it is inferior to Wild Wild West, which, despite your feelings about the movie, that song is a jam. I don't know what to tell you.
I was thinking about this earlier. It's a title tie-in track, and we don't really get many of those these days, other than
the last Bond time movie. We got that.
Bond movies and Snakes on a Plane.
Oh, you know what? No, I think that Emancipation of Harley Quinn, they had like a tie-in song. Didn't it have like Megan Thee Stallion and like Normani on it? It wasn't a good song.
Was it called the title though?
Oh, I don't know. I don't remember. And then there was that Don't Call Me Angel, that terrible song with Ariana and Miley and Lana Del Rey.
And
it was called like, maybe it wasn't called Charlie's Angels.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like there's still songs from movies.
Also, those were bad examples because those were both not great songs. So.
Not great songs. Yeah. Wiki Wild Wild West. And then that's like, I feel like that's the last kind of Millennium's like the last big Will Smith album, because there's one that comes out that has that song Switch.
Two more come out.
Yeah.
One that comes out in 2002, and then his last one came out in 2005. He has a single, like if you look at his Spotify, I didn't listen to the song, but it's just called Will, and it's like him and some rapper that I've never heard of.
Okay.
But I'm sure I'm just making myself sound older than I am.
It
was Joyner Lucas and Will Smith. It was a remix of the song called Will. I don't know. It came out last year. And he has another single called Give It Up with Nicki Jam. I don't know. Yeah. Also, I've not heard that either.
I would just like to point out that Wild Wild West has a Rotten Tomatoes score of, can you guess, Margo?
17, because I saw that earlier.
Well, and they won 5 Golden Raspberry Awards, most of which were collected by Robert Conrad, who played Jim West in the original TV series, because he was so angry about this movie. That is petty.
Wait, what? How did that happen?
The TV show, Wild Wild West.
Yes, no, I got that. And I know it's the original. How do you give it to the original actor?
So the Golden Raspberries, they invited this man to the Golden Raspberries, and they allowed him to accept the Golden Raspberries for the movie Wild Wild West.
I see what you mean. They weren't awarded to him. He just accepted the award.
He accepted them on behalf of the movie because he thought it was utter shit and was really unhappy with it.
Look, I think all around everybody recognizes that this was a mistake and we shouldn't have done it. Like, Westworld, this is not. And even, you know, I'm only talking about the first season of Westworld, really. Yeah. So I understand. And I think, I don't know, I don't want to say it contributed. Maybe it did contribute to big high budget, high concept comedy is sort of not really staying a thing after this. Like, it started to become diminishing returns. I mean, I think it also kind of has to do with, like, there are no Will Smiths. I guess you can kind of say that Kevin Hart can possibly open stuff all by himself, but I don't remember his last big hit. I mean, like, that he was carrying, because, like, Jumanji is obviously a hit, but that's an ensemble thing.
Yeah, I would say, like, other than Dwayne Johnson, see, I made sure to just
good call job, good
Dwayne
job,
Johnson,
I'm proud of you.
Dwayne Johnson. Even Dwayne Johnson, like, he'll have a few where he's the star, but they tend to also have a second name on the credit, right? Like
Jason Statham,
Hobbs and Shaw. Great, great spinoff. Yeah. I think that's, like, it is, you're absolutely right. Like, I think that you're right. He is really a part of kind of like this last group of kind of classic 20th century blockbuster stars that one name alone on top of a marquee will bring you an audience. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I think also the success of Will Onion really buffered him from Wild Wild West being detrimental. It was that, and then it was followed up by Legend of Bagger Vance, which was also a dud, but not. It wasn't as high priced of a dud and as public as of a dud as Wild Wild West was.
It was a smaller budget, and then also he immediately goes into Ali after. Yeah. So,
and it wasn't 4th of July weekend, which this was, which is something that he had owned for, what is it, 4 years running.
Right, exactly. No, I think it's interesting that he continued the streak, but I also think it's interesting that he was able to take what had been, you know, a flop, in which, you know, we say it's a flop, it's still profited, but you know what I mean. And then a few years later, he gets his first Oscar nomination and then follows it up a few years later with yet another one. So I bet you with King Richard, you know, there's going to be Oscar buzz for sure.
Oh, yeah. It's being released at peak Oscar bait time. Like, it's holiday. It's like end of November, December, which is exactly when all of the Oscar movies start to get rolled out. And and they waited. So now you can actually see it in theaters. And I wonder if they'll do like a dual release, but probably not.
Are the Williams sisters behind it? Like, are they producing it?
I don't know if they're producing it, but if you read that GQ article, they reached out to Serena for a comment, my close friend Serena Williams, and I realized I said her name as if we are friends. They reached out to her about what she thought about the movie because she's already watched a cut. I believe she was like present for some of like the festival circuit that it was on, and she essentially gave the project her blessing and said that his portrayal of her father is so spot on. She had to remind herself that she was watching Will Smith and not her dad.
Wow.
And I guess they have a lot in common because I was really surprised by how much he talked about his father in the GQ article and, you know, has a lot of similarities with Richard Williams himself and how he drew on a lot of inspiration from his dad who passed away in 2016. But I think he also says that his dad dying in 2016 has made him feel more comfortable talking more publicly about his dad and, you know, and not just like the sunny stuff. I really enjoyed the GQ piece. I thought it was very interesting, like him being a lifelong people pleaser and coming from an abusive household and if you come from an abusive household, you either have like a freeze reaction or you have a fawn reaction. It tends to be one of the two. And a fawn is like somebody who also like is like at their core is a people pleaser and always wants to just give people exactly what they want. And he talks about how difficult it's been for him to establish boundaries and like keep them.
Yeah, that it's interesting you bring that up though. You remember when Tiffany Haddish told the story of like when they went on a Groupon thing to a boat show and like it's interesting you bring up the people pleasing part because even on that he had to be like, okay, everyone, let's just enjoy the show. And then after, you know, I'll stand for pictures or autographs or whatever. Like there's a little bit of that in that story even.
For sure. And I think he talks about it towards the end of the article about how the interviewer had asked him some pretty pointed questions about his relationship with Jada. And he actually, instead of he wanted to immediately tell him whatever he thought or his truth or whatever. And he paused and was like, I actually should talk to my wife and then I'll get back to you. And then when he called him back, he's like, 3 years ago, it would totally pain me to not give you exactly what you want. But I think it's for the best that I just sort of like leave it where we left it. And I'm really sorry that that's unsatisfying. But the interviewer who has won Pulitzers was just like, yeah, I fully understand. Like, we should respect you having boundaries. Just because you've made yourself accessible for so long doesn't mean that we get to demand that of you. So I find that to be, I find Will Smith's like later career to be very, very interesting.
I agree. Well, as we end this episode, do you have any final thoughts about Will Smith?
I'm excited to see this next chapter of his career and like how lucky are we that we get to follow a superstar's career essentially from beginning to end, like from his rapping duo, which, you know, we were sort of caught the tail end of, but mostly like Fresh Prince, and to just see his evolution and think critically about his career, I think is so fun and fascinating because he isn't problematic, like sort of in the ways that like Tom Cruise is with Scientology. Like, we can just enjoy Will Smith and he accepts the criticism and he like takes responsibility for stuff. And he just, I don't know, seems like such a genuinely nice person. And so it's just so, it's just been fascinating to like watch his career kind of change and evolve over time. And there's just really nobody else like him.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Well, thank you again for listening to our podcast. If you like what you heard, you can check out our other episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Audible, Pocket Casts, Amazon, wherever you like to listen. And the best way to stay up to date on our latest episodes is to subscribe to our pod. And while you're hitting that subscribe button, maybe leave us a rating and a review. Additionally, we are on social media. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook at The Old Millennials Pod. And finally, you can find us individually on Twitter. I am at Emily A. Beijin.
And I'm at Marg She Wrote.
And until next time, we say bye-bye.
Bye.